From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jill Kaufman, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, the fight over short-term rentals takes a sort of personal turn as Airbnb sets Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu in its sights. Also today, Massachusetts schools that specialize in educating young people with addiction are looking for more money.
These moments with Harry where he's come back and has been in treatment.
Don't act like you don't see me, bro.
And without notice, the very next week, Harry could be on the street carrying 20 bags of heroin.
And months after the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, the parents of a 17-year-old student killed are speaking openly about what's lost.
That day, once you go through all that pain, they will never leave my heart or my wife's heart or my daughter's heart. It's going to be there forever.
They've turned that pain into activism, and they're in Massachusetts this week. It's next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. Boston officials continue to look at how to regulate Airbnb and other short-term rental companies. And earlier this week, Airbnb, the company that dominates the industry, decided to take the issue directly to Boston residents and in a somewhat unconventional way. On Tuesday, thousands received an email from Airbnb that specifically named Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu and her proposal to regulate short-term rentals. The company said they were unreasonable. And despite some negative social media pushback to the email, Airbnb doubled down later in the day, same day, Tuesday, with a written statement calling Wu's proposal anti-tenant and anti-middle class. We invited Airbnb to join us today on the show. They declined. They did send us an official statement, which reads in part, Airbnb supports the regulation of home sharing, which is why we've been working hand in hand with the city of Boston and local communities on reasonable rules for the last 2 years. We're encouraged to see that Councillor Wu does not support a night cap on home sharing, and we look forward to getting back to working collaboratively with the city to put fair regulations in place. For the full statement, you could check out our website, radioboston.org. And we also have Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu with us. She joins us by phone. Thanks so much for taking the time today to join us.
Thanks for having me.
So it's unclear exactly, Councilor Wu, who received this email, presumably Airbnb users in the Boston area, but we also did at WBUR. What did you think when you saw that Airbnb email on Tuesday?
You know, you never know what you're going to find when you open up Twitter, but I was more than surprised to learn online that I was specifically named in an email that was not only a little bit subjective in its characterizations of my aligning with certain interests over others, but also contained some major misinformation.
Right. The email had it wrong that you had it said that you had mentioned you were pushing for a 30-day cap on stays, overnight stays when the owner was not at home. That's not something you proposed. Have you heard from Airbnb since? Have you picked up the phone and called the company? And it's very hard to reach somebody in corporate there. But what's the status there?
I have not had any communication with them or from them. I've actually been at a conference in D.C., which is why I'm joining you by phone today. So I have not had the chance to reach out and certainly haven't received any contact from them. There are many, many platforms involved in short-term rentals across Boston, so they're really not the only sort of corporate party that that would be subject to regulation. We've had hearings and working sessions, and any number of representatives of these companies have attended, so it was a little bit surprising to see that they had the facts wrong. And in fact, there is currently no pending legislation before the council on Airbnb or short-term rental.
Right. There is an ordinance that's proposed. Is that's correct?
Actually, no, because the mayor had proposed an ordinance several weeks ago. Councilor Lydia Edwards and I had proposed an amendment to that ordinance, which did include eliminating the investor unit category and tightening the regulations a bit in our perspective to make sure that we're closing corporate loopholes that allow for de facto hotels. However, The time clock on the mayor's proposal ran out and it was withdrawn. So we've had further discussions on what the next iteration of legislation might look like, but no formal proposal has been re-entered to the council.
So there's something in the works, but nothing on paper yet, and it's something you're still at. I know that you are on record saying that a 90-day cap would be a 90-day cap on stays, just to be speaking outside the industry, would be too lenient for Airbnb hosts to have, or for, I'm sorry, for short-term stays. What is the happy medium here with limits on how many nights a property can be rented by a homeowner, let's say, in the city of Boston? What are you thinking at this point?
So for me, it's really not so much about the number of nights, but about who is doing the renting or who is offering the home for rent. We have very different categories of users of Airbnb, and many of them in Boston are residents who either are sharing an extra room in their home to help them make the mortgage payment, or sharing their entire home when they go on vacation in order to help pay for that vacation. And none of us want to see that sort of the benefits of home sharing for residents diminished. However, we do see some major corporate use of Airbnb where investors are purchasing whole buildings or multiple floors of buildings and essentially setting up de facto hotels where they're taking housing stock, turning them into tourist stays of 2, 3, 4 nights at a time. And what was once long-term residences with neighbors who are part of the community has now become this de facto hotel use. And that, you know, tourism is important for Boston, but we desperately need our housing stock. We're in the midst of a housing crisis, and we know that that drives up prices.
Going forward, though, if you were to repropose something, you among city councilors or the mayor himself putting a proposal, it would really shine the light differently on what you find out to be corporately owned buildings versus regular folks who are just trying to be able to pay their mortgage, is what you're saying. You're able to delineate that.
Exactly. The amendments that Councillor Edwards and I had proposed eliminated the investor category altogether. So you would not be able to rent out or offer on the platform somewhere that you were not living, except for two exemptions that we had created. One for owner occupants of 2 and 3 family homes to be able to offer an extra unit on that platform 365 days a year, and for corporate furnished stays of 10 nights or more in a row. That's to get at it's a slightly different market of, you know, serving employees who are relocating from another city, or, you know, professors, researchers here on sabbatical for a semester. A different category, again, from the tourist de facto hotel use.
Let's step back into the cap idea. And I want to hear now from Boston's chief of housing, Sheila Dillon. We have her on tape. She was speaking about the mayor's proposal, which included, again, it's a past proposal at this point, the 90-day cap. One of the arguments that has been used to support putting regulations on the short-term rental industry, Airbnb and others included, is that it takes available units off the market, as you were saying, driving up rent costs.
Research has shown that there's about 2,000 units right now that are rented more than 235 days per year. So those units we've really lost. And we only have about 3,000 vacant units in the city at any given time. So this will provide a larger vacancy rate, which is good for the city. It brings down rents.
So it's not clear if that's true or not. A recent paper from the National Bureau of Economic Research, which we'll have on our website later, it found that a 1% increase in Airbnb listings leads to only 0.018% increase in rent. That's a small number, Councillor Wu. How much of the push for regulations then is about addressing this housing issue versus just making sure everyone is playing fair, that it's, you know, individuals versus corporations?
It's all of the above, but we do know from, you know, it's one thing to talk about generalized statistics and numbers across large urban swaths. But if you think about it neighborhood by neighborhood, we're really seeing the impact. In Chinatown, for example, row house after row house has been sold, sort of all cash, the long-term residents kicked out and turned into these de facto hotels that would violate zoning laws if a sort of standard hotel were proposed. So we know that this is happening, particularly in the downtown area. The research that our residents have done shows that Boston's downtown area actually has 3 times the density of these multi-unit long-term Airbnbs as even New York City. So it's having an impact in Boston. It's really starting to spread into every neighborhood. We want to make sure that we're taking every possible step to address the housing crisis and help ease the pressure on rents. But it is about more than that. It's about community and keeping our long-term residents as residents, not displacing people, and also making sure that corporations aren't exploiting a loophole.
Right. I want to ask you about that bigger picture that, you know, that you are referring to, which is about affordable housing and the crunch, of a growing and prosperous city, relatively speaking. Boston has a lot of innovative ideas in its housing arena, and there's this additional dwelling unit Pilot Loan Program, the ADUPLP, I guess. It helps residents in certain neighborhoods in the city get these interest-free loans, no monthly payments, until the owner sells or refinances the home. It allows them, if it works out, to maybe build a studio apartment in a basement if it's zoning, you know, coded okay. It helps them stay in their homes. It helps provide an affordable housing unit to the city. This is just one effort. I assume, you know, that battling against the short-term rentals is a small percentage of creating a more robust, affordable housing market.
Yes, it's certainly just one tool in the entire toolbox of actions that need to be taken. The city's Housing Innovation Lab under Chief Dillon has been doing a lot of great policy research, including all of the work on ADUs. We have a lot more work to do, but again, this is something, regulating short-term rentals and doing it in a reasonable way is something that is within our jurisdiction to do and would have an immediate impact. However small, if it helps, we need to take that step.
I want to ask you just briefly as we wrap up, Councillor Wu, are you speaking with officials in other cities about how they're handling what their housing market and the need for this kind of short-term rentals, both for the homeowner, maybe for the traveler, and maybe for, you know, me going to Boston, coming in from Western Massachusetts like I do?
It's a lot to balance, and cities across the country, as you refer to, are trying to figure out their own ways of balancing it. It has to be tailored to each individual municipality, but we're lucky in that even locally, Cambridge just enacted regulations and put a lot of thought into it. So we've looked at San Francisco, New York, Cambridge, all of the cities that have taken proactive steps already. Some sort of reasonable regulation needs to happen. It's clear that there are just blatant violations of zoning as going on right now, as mentioned, through these loopholes that allow de facto hotels. So we have to rein it in, set the expectations to be able to maintain Boston as a place that people can live and raise a family.
Okay, we will check back in with you, with the other city officials as well, as this evolves. Thank you so much for joining us today from Washington, D.C. Michelle Wu, Boston City Councilor. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. We're taking a look now at the type of school in Massachusetts that specializes in treating and educating high school students who have addictions, alcohol, drugs, including opioids. There are five of these types of high schools in the state. They're public high schools in Boston, Brockton, Springfield, Worcester, and Beverly. The first one opened up in Massachusetts in 2006. Here's a scene from an ABC Nightline documentary about a recovery high school here in Worcester. This is Principal Susan Strong speaking with a student named Harry when she suspects he may be using again.
You look pretty high right now.
No, I've done a perk.
What other stuff? So, have you shot heroin
yet? No.
That's like a one-way road for you because you almost died. And we might not be so lucky to have two shots of Narcan to bring Harry back to us.
Oh, yeah, I feel that.
Yeah, so that's what's killing me. And that's what's killing Alyssa because we don't want that to happen.
It is a more expensive high school to run, with transportation being individualized. Low teacher-student ratio means more teachers need to be hired. And those teachers are not just teaching English and earth science, but how to stay sober. On Beacon Hill, the House budget has a couple of amendments to increase funding, and we're going to learn more about this from WBUR reporter Allison Poley. Thanks for coming into the studio today.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us about the schools and about the students and their needs in it overall?
Of course. So as you mentioned, these are public schools, and the students who are attending are struggling with substance abuse disorders. And that includes everything from alcoholism to opioid addictions. Now, the schools are small. They average only a few dozen students, and they create sober environments where the kids have access to group therapy, to mental health counselors, and to a recovery counselor who can provide drug testing and personalized treatment plans to help these students stay sober. And now it's because of this specialized environment that some students travel more than an hour each way to get to school. And a lot of the students who I've talked to say that the support that they get from these communities is vital to helping them stay sober and learn who they are without drugs.
And have you've been in these schools, buildings, and reporting on this over the last bit of time?
Yeah, over the last few years.
So there is an opioid crisis in the U.S. There's very much so one in the state of Massachusetts. Are there more students with this kind of addiction in these schools? And is that why? Does that contribute to these schools being more in demand?
They figured out a way to be able to get more students to the schools with transportation. So there's always been a need for these schools. But now with more funding for transportation, they have figured out a way to get these students to the schools. But there are more of them being opened across the country, too.
Is there more schools needed because of the opioid crisis, or is that, you know, sort of, it's a part of it, but not necessarily?
That's certainly a part of it. Yeah, a lot of the students are struggling with opioid addictions.
Talk about more about transportation. So five schools around the state, students may have to go from, let's say, Cape Cod to a school in Brockton. That is expensive. It's not a bus full of students. It is, it seems like individualized transportation.
It could be a van, or some parents are responsible or guardians for getting the students to the school, or even their responsible for figuring it out themselves. So the state budget currently funds transportation costs for regional school districts, vocational schools, and for homeless students, but not for recovery high school students. So that's why many of these students who are coming to the recovery high schools from districts in the area need to figure out a way to get there. Of course. So under federal law, school districts are required to provide services to students with disabilities to meet their educational and mental health needs, but they're not required to transport students on the sole basis of their substance abuse disorder, which is why the recovery high schools have had to make up the cost.
And if these students are in halfway houses or are considered homeless because they might be in foster care, which is a federal designation, as I understand it, is there other federal money that could, do you know if that could help in transportation, paying for transportation costs? Our schools, I mean, maybe we can ask that when we get to the school building itself.
Yeah, that could be helpful in paying for them, but there is still a huge need for transportation funding for the five existing recovery high schools.
So getting to that, in Massachusetts, it's possible that schools could receive less funding, as I understand it, overall next year in the big picture. How is it that possible when the needs are very clearly there? I mean, a lot of districts will say this as well. And talk about the House amendments right now that are making their way around Beacon Hill. What would they do to make a difference in the funding?
Sure. So the governor's budget proposed $2.475 million. And now the governor's office has said that that's level funded. But advocates for these schools say that that doesn't include money that the five schools have split over the past few years that has come from the Department of Public Health. So that's where the House budget comes in. There's a new amendment from Representative Liz Malia of Boston, which would allocate $3.6 million to the five recovery high schools. And it also increases the base level funding for each school. So right now, each school gets $500,000 from the state, but under this new amendment, they'd get $620,000 each.
All right. WBUR reporter Allison Poley, thank you so much for joining us today. And you can read her whole story at radioboston.org. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to continue this conversation about recovery schools in Massachusetts and across the country as well. We're joined by phone by Andy Finch. He's a professor at Vanderbilt University who specializes in the topic of recovery schools. Welcome to you, Andy.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you. We're also joined in the studio by Ryan Morgan, who's a principal at the Independence Academy Sober Recovery High School in Brockton. It's one of five. Welcome to you, sir.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to be able to continue this conversation. Can you please discuss, if you would, Mr. Morgan, who the students are at Independence Academy and what a day looks like?
Sure. Thank you. The students at Independence Academy come from the region of southeastern Massachusetts. They're high school age students, you know, ranging in ages from 14 to, I think, 19 is our oldest student. And I think if you walked in the schools of Independence Academy, you would kind of be shocked that the population that you're looking at is a population that struggles with the things that they struggle with. And
why is that? I mean, why would I be shocked?
I think when you talk to people about, you know, adolescents who struggle with addiction and struggle with some of the issues that our students struggle with, everybody has kind of painted this picture in their mind of what a recovery high school student might look like, or what, you know, a student who's diagnosed with a substance use disorder at 15, you know, might look like. And I think if you walked in and you looked at our students, you'd see just a group of great kids who are all, you know, really working hard at trying to, you know, get their diploma and maintain sobriety. And, you know, just a friendly group of kids with smiling faces. And, you know, it's certainly not all always, you know, I don't know, beautiful and perfect, but, it's just, it's a great group of kids. And
But there are these issues that got them there in the first place, which behind those issues are other issues. I would imagine that addiction is what got them there, not being able to thrive, I guess, in their own high school, got them to your school or to the other schools in the state. What's the tipping point that brought them into your school? What happens enough that somebody has to leave their district?
Yeah, I think most of our students have completed substance use treatment, inpatient substance use treatment, and you know, it's not the first time that they've been caught with a substance, or first time that they've been found under the influence of a substance, or been identified as maybe struggling. I think it's, for many of our students, it's been a long road of, you know, losing relationships and losing opportunities and just negative school experiences, just given kind of the current climate of how to address a student who struggles with substance use in a public high school, usually is grounded in suspension or some sort of disciplinary action. So, you know, students who are really working hard at trying to maintain sobriety and work on their recovery, you know, are looking for an environment that understands them, that's non-judgmental, and that, you know, in addition to working with them on their academics, really takes a head-on approach to helping them figure out, you know, the different domains of their life that are certainly necessary to facilitate recovery and are impacted by substance use.
All right. Andy Finch, joining us by phone at Vanderbilt. Can you help us take a step back and look at the bigger picture of these kinds of schools around the country? How many of there are there, for instance, and how much has that number grown in the past few years?
Yeah, there's about 40 of them nationally right now that we're aware of, and you do see them clustered in certain states like Massachusetts that does have a funding model that has supported the schools. We've seen rapid growth, especially since about 2000, the late 1990s, but these schools have been around for quite a while. The first school that we know of opened in Maryland in 1979. And so, you know, we've had recovery high schools in the country for quite a while, but certainly in the late 90s, early 2000s, when we started to see innovative types of funding, more open enrollment type policies in states around the country, schools like this fit right into that pocket. We did see some decline during the recession when states were tightening the belt, and oftentimes it became difficult to sustain specialty programming. But certainly since about 2013, 2014, we've seen really rapid growth in the number of schools and a real increase in demand.
So to clarify, that decline was not because of a decline in the number of kids needing these services, but as you're saying, a decline in budgets. I want to ask both Ryan Morgan from the school in Brockton and Andy Finch, both of you, how do schools, if you can describe, how do they balance helping a student with a big issue like recovering from addiction, but also teach them what they need to learn in high school to be able to graduate? And if the goal is still with this general idea, graduate, go off, learn a trade, go to college, is that a hard balance? And is it also about just keeping them alive? Ryan Morgan, if we could start with you as from a school-based perspective.
Yeah, I think it's really it's a difficult balance. And I think that that's why, in my opinion, recovery high schools need to be their standalone schools, as opposed to being a program that's run, you know, within an existing school, because the balance is so hard to strike. At certain days, you have to just kind of put recovery first and, you know, make sure that student is healthy and in many cases, you know, has a place to stay and is certainly safe. And so a lot of our efforts with students who are in early recovery is really focused on a lot of that, and you kind of work in academics when that student's ready. But, you know, I personally would like to kind of get rid of the whole, you know, you're a senior now because it's your fourth year in high school and you need to graduate. I'd rather, you know, take more of an individualized approach and say, you know, we're going to keep you here an extra year because, you know, yeah, we want you to graduate, but we want you to be healthy and we want you to be stable before we do that. So it is a difficult balance.
And Andy Finch at Vanderbilt, I imagine that your research on these types of schools takes you inside of buildings, at least I hope it does. And I wonder if you're seeing different styles or different models of how schools are managing to strike this balance.
And certainly, and I've been involved in a couple of national research studies in which I have had the opportunity to visit schools across the country, and it's true. You do see different models. And matter of fact, you really don't see just one type of recovery high school. They develop around what resources are available in their communities, what types of treatment is available to students. And so there are pieces of them that look very different, and yet at their heart, they are very similar in that they are supporting the long-term recovery of students. I think the population that he's just described in Brockton would be a similar population that you would see in schools around the country, and their programming is pretty similar as well.
Let's say, if you could say more about that programming, yeah. Meaning what does a day look like, striking that balance? What does the day begin with? What does it end with? What kinds of classes are there?
The balance between recovery and academics is always there. And I think they are identified as recovery schools because they're supporting that long-term recovery. But at the end of the day, they're academic institutions. They're trying to help students earn a diploma. And they're not treatment centers. That's not their purpose. And so supporting that long-term recovery means that students might be there a couple of years in some cases, maybe longer. And so it is a school. And so when you ask about that day to day, you're going to see academics going on. Now, you might see smaller class sizes of about 10 students. But when you walk into that class, you'll see students doing math. You'll see them doing English, science. But what you'll also see are perhaps support groups built in to the day, maybe the whole school or maybe a portion of the school. Or in the audio clip you just played, you see a real focus on the individual student needs. So if a student is in crisis, whether it's around drug use, mental health, or something else, they have the ability to tune into that student. And it's okay for that student to say, see a counselor, talk to a recovery coach, or just step aside and talk to a teacher about their struggles. And that's welcome.
So
the last thing that I would emphasize is that it is an environment that it's very supportive peer supports. You don't see the power of teacher over student so much. It's much more seen as a collaborative environment. And so the entire culture would feel different than what we might see in most of our traditional schools in the country.
And I want to zero in, Andy Finch, on something you said, which is that the schools are not treatment centers. So Ryan Morgan in Brockton at the Independence Academy Sober Recovery High School, if they're not treatment centers, that means that are you also needing to ensure that these kids are getting additional services when they leave school? Is that more, you know, I don't mean to use the term warm handoff, which is a term used in the world of opioid addiction, but who are you handing off these kids to at the end of the day?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question mark for us. And what we try to do is connect kids with resources in their communities. And so whether it's an in-home therapist or a mentor or a peer group, you know, outside of the school, you know, that's part of our pitch. It's, if you look at SAMHSA's four, you know, kind of dimensions for their, you know, approach to recovery, it's home, health, community, and purpose. And, you know, we really focus on those four facets and try to get students to identify the supports that are in their community. We try to work on their home and try to, you know, educate their family as well and work with their family. A lot of times families have presenting issues as well as a unit. And so, again, the recovery counselor, a clinician that's working within our school, you know, does a lot of family work during the day. And I think, like Dr. Finch said, you know, there's some individualized focus for kids who are in crisis. There's some small group and there's some large group. And there's also a strong family component that we try to incorporate into the work that we do
right,
as well.
Right. None of this happens without, you know, in a vacuum. We have about a minute left. I just want to ask you if you both can get an answer in. We'll see what happens. The issues behind this. What is going on in, and, you know, we can probably make some guesses, in our communities, in our systems, that there's more of a need for these schools? And maybe, Ryan Morgan, if you can begin, because you're based in one.
Sure. And I'll be quick. I think what's going on is that adolescent substance use and mental health and trauma is certainly becoming more and more prevalent. And I think that there's some substances that people are glossing over due to the opioid epidemic, particularly the substances that adolescents particularly start using around 11 or 12. And I think that, you know, we need to make a concerted effort on working with students who aren't necessarily using opioids, but, you know, start addressing issues around marijuana use at 11 and 12, especially chronic marijuana use, alcohol use, and over-the-counter prescription pills.
Right, more available. And Andy Finch, as a researcher, are you seeing a trend that you can point to that says, wow, this is absolutely there. It needs to be addressed. I mean, what's happening in the school building is one thing, but the bigger picture of addressing the issues.
I certainly think we've been seeing a larger number of overdose deaths, which I think has brought attention to this issue, perhaps like we've not seen in decades. And so I think for that reason, there's more funding available. I think the need has been pretty constant, quite honestly. I think that we've had a need for programs for many, many years. And I think what we're finally seeing are people stepping up and saying, we want schools like this in our community. And I think there's finally funding available to support them. So you're seeing an expansion of the program.
Right. And more, of course, to say on the funding question in Massachusetts, at least, as things are in the lurch a bit. Andy Finch at Vanderbilt University, researcher in the recovery schools movement. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Ryan Morgan, good luck to you on back as the school year begins to wrap up, I imagine. I would love to know what a success looks like really quickly. Have you sent kids back into their district?
Oh, yeah, quite a bit. Yeah, we send kids back to district. We keep kids until graduation. We transition kids to high-set programs and colleges and things like that. So, you know, I would say we have a whole range of exit options for kids. And, you know, we continue to try to just make sure that the kids are healthy, I think, is the number one thing.
All right. Stay in touch with us. Ryan Morgan, thank you so much. Principal at the Independence Academy Sober Recovery High School in Brockton.
Thank you.
This week, most students in Boston are on vacation, but at 28 schools playing host to what are known as acceleration academies, another type of school, struggling students and teachers are working hard to get ahead. As WBUR's Max Larkin reports, the approach is a collision between two different ideas of education reform.
Chanel Andrews is pretty new to teaching.
I came in 2014. This is my fourth year.
If summoning her exact start date takes a second, it may be because those have been four difficult years. Just as Andrews started working at the Henry Grew Elementary School in Hyde Park, Massachusetts Education Commissioner labeled it one of the state's most poorly performing schools. That meant its teachers were laid off and asked to reapply for their jobs. Those who stayed faced hours of extra training, uncertainty, and high turnover, all while officials held the school under the microscope.
They come in, they interview teachers, they take observations on what they see, they try to rate us on like how we're doing in certain categories, like how we're doing with parent-family communication, how we're doing with instructional planning.
Andrews is one of just four teachers to have stayed on throughout the turnaround process. Teachers' unions have long criticized that heavy-handed approach to struggling schools. Boston Teachers Union President Jessica Tang says the district has practiced mass layoffs for years with little evidence that it really does turn around poor performance. And it comes at an enormous cost.
You're tearing apart the relationships between the students and the teachers, the parents and the teachers. You lose institutional knowledge. It is harmful.
Meanwhile, Tang says, schools where class sizes are small and teachers are trusted tend to thrive. This winter, Chanel Andrews put in a lot more extra hours trying to build just that kind of educational environment at the GRU. Andrews was coordinating the school's Acceleration Academy, a one-week crash course over February vacation.
All right, you ready?
Yes!
At the GRU, that meant the school cafeteria was turned into a combination workshop, classroom, and performance space. On a stage, three third-grade boys launched into a Caribbean dance they had choreographed. Meanwhile, in the back of the cafeteria, other students built instruments out of household objects while teachers looked on. Andrews designed this interdisciplinary curriculum with her fellow teachers. It's got STEM, history, cultural heritage education. Third-grader Joy Robinson sat designing her Cuban guitar out of cardboard.
Does it feel like school?
No. Because you get to do different things like dance, math, reading. And my favorite thing is basically dance and research.
About 1,500 students are taking part in similar academies at 27 other Boston schools over February and April vacations this year. They're designed to pair schools' most dedicated teachers with a handful of students who are still finding their footing. Their goal is to turn around academic performance, but not by the drill and kill tactics sometimes employed in the past.
It's not test prep in any way. It's really about quality instruction. You know, kids are excited by it. They want to participate. They want to be in school on vacations because they have these opportunities.
That's Jeff Riley. He first dreamed up the idea 10 years ago when he was principal of a Boston middle school. There's evidence that it works. Education experts at Harvard who studied acceleration academies in Lawrence found that they increased performance by impressive margins. That's the paradox. A reform for schools that have fallen behind on test scores is making progress by focusing, it seems, on everything but. Riley says this kind of educational experience is rare in urban schools.
The reality is we don't often get to have classes with 10 to 12 kids in them, right? And that's not the ideal situation.
He calls this the adrenaline shot version, forming small, close-knit academies over week-long vacations. Last month, Jeff Riley was appointed the state's new commissioner of education. From that post, he'll oversee which schools are judged to be failing and what will happen to them. Riley says he believes test scores are still an important tool, but he does see problems with the way struggling schools have been handled up till now.
There was some blaming of teachers in the past, and I think that's a really wrong way to look at it. We need to celebrate them, and we need to support them and recognize that they are on the front lines and are doing the work with the kids.
That was February vacation at the GRU. This April, another teacher is running another academy, and instead of being in Hyde Park, Chanel Andrews is on a staff trip to Scandinavia, visiting top schools there and learning how to be a better teacher.
That's WBUR reporter Max Larkin. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. More than 2 months ago, Nicholas Cruz allegedly entered the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, and he opened fire. In all, he shot and killed 17 people, and another 17 were left wounded. Among the dead was 17-year-old Joaquin Oliver, and his friends and family called him Guac for short. The gun used in the shooting, an assault-style M&P-15 weapon, is manufactured by Smith & Wesson in Springfield, Massachusetts, and Joaquin Oliver's parents, in memory of their son and to advocate for greater gun control, are speaking publicly against gun violence. They're here in our studio right now. They'll be in Springfield tomorrow to unveil an art installation titled Walls of Demand near the Smith & Wesson factory. Thank you so much for coming in, Manuel and Patricia Oliver. Appreciate your time in here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This can't be easy.
He's not.
To be out talking about your son. I'd love to hear about him, though, before we talk about what you're doing in town. Please tell me about your son. Tell me who he was and what he loved to do. What was he about?
Joaquin was a wonderful person. He was always making sure that everybody will be okay. He was in love with fairness, like everything needed to be positive. Not only for him, for his family, but also for his friends and new people that he will meet. He will always be taking care of people. Mm-hmm. He was a very protective person.
Was he a junior or senior?
He was a senior.
He was a senior. Right. Do you know what his plans were? What he was hoping to do after high school?
He had a few thoughts. Very creative human being. But we do remember one conversation asking him, so what are you going to do? What are your plans in life? And he will answer more than once, I don't know yet, but it's going to be really big. I'm going to be doing some great things. Mm-hmm. That was an actual conversation. That was a level of conversations that we had with our son.
Did you see an artistic streak in him? I'm just looking at knowing one parent, at least one parent is an artist. Did he have that quality? Creative, yes, but
he had it in a writing way. He was a great writer. What I do when it comes to art is more painting, but Joaquin was an awesome writer. I mean, being here for only 14 years, he was 100% bilingual, of course. But he will also be one of the best students from the creative writing class.
Mm-hmm. To explain that you came here from Venezuela when he was 3 years old, that's right. And you have a another child.
Yes, we do.
And
we have Andrea. She's 25.
25. Okay.
And she was very close to Joaquin. Also, right. They were very 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 nice friends to each other. They were supporting to each other a lot.
Did she, when she was in high school, did she go to the same school?
Yeah, she went to the same school.
I also know that he, what I heard was that he loved basketball and that that was a big part of his life. So I imagine, I know you're going to be in Springfield tomorrow, so there's being in Springfield for a very specific reason, but the Basketball Hall of Fame being there is quite something too. I hope that he knows that somewhere
out
there.
I know. Yeah. It's funny that you bring that, because actually, ironically, in the invitation that we are just posting on social media, we're letting people know that we're going to be in the home of the Basketball Hall of Fame and headquarters of Smith & Wesson. So
as I sit here and look at you, and I have to say again, it's remarkable that you can come out and speak publicly just a few months after after this loss, this huge loss. I'd love to hear now about the art that you're bringing around the country, not just to Springfield. In particular, Springfield is where this gun was manufactured, or at least by the same company. What's on the mural? What's going to be involved in the unveiling tomorrow?
The murals, it's a project under the organization that we started it. Our organization name is Change the Ref. And part of that project that we're doing includes art through the Walls of Demand. So Walls of Demand, it started it by coincidence. We were invited by Wade, the Heat superstar basketball player, to be part of a gallery where he was going to show some. He was going to honor the victims of Portland. And it happened that in that gallery there was an empty wall, and I had the option of doing some painting and writing some words demanding a change.
This is after the shooting.
This is after the shooting, and it became impactful. A lot of people were involved with the idea of bringing art. There was also an immediate connection between we as parents of a victim and the leaders of the youth movement. So that made perfect sense for us, because at that point we understood that Joaquin is one of them as long as we give him a voice and a presence.
They're remarkable young people. What does Change the Ref, though, mean? I'm not sure if I understand that.
Change the Ref, it's a name that actually Joaquin created. We were in a basketball game. I used to coach his team. And one day, the ref made terrible calls, and he was expulsed from the game. And he asked me to do something, so when I went to fix things, I was also expulsed from the game. So we were both driving back home. He said, "Dad, you know what? I don't think there's any way that we can have a fair game with this ref. Actually, I think there's a connection between him and the other team." So then it happened what we all know, and those words were a perfect definition of what is going on in Congress today. If one of the teams is somehow connected to the ref or giving money to the ref is not able to make a decision under fairness, or what we call a fair game. So the main mission of Change the Ref is to clean any connection with any super lobby, NRA, directly or indirectly, with any of the Congress people that is representing us.
Would you describe now the mural itself, and describe what it means to be, I don't know if you're painting multiple murals and leaving them places on sheets, or if you're carrying one around, but what does it mean to physically make art that is so much about this loss, and describe what it looks like? And Patricia, I'm sorry, I don't know if you're making also painting. So
no, I do not paint. I just support Manuel, my husband. Right. So we are together in this movement, and I support him. But I'm not an artist at all.
She's in her way. We're also showing that we are a strong family, and we like to show that we are together in this. We travel together. So, it's the art. The way I see this is not me being an artist; it's Joaquin being an activist. Okay, mm-hmm.
Well, what does it look like? I need to have an image. So
there's images of Joaquin that we have used in several of the walls, in all of them. And then we write with a roller and paint. We demand, and that demand could change from one place to the other. So we demanded a change. We demanded a life. We demanded different things.
Different cities so far.
In different cities, yeah.
And leaving the murals in place.
The murals stay there. Actually, the final destination of the mural, we're not worried about that. They could go from one place to the other according to the location. For us, the on that side of our foundation, the goal is to being able to create 17 murals in 17 different cities.
And for you to physically create this, is it more difficult than you could imagine? Is it like being with your son? Is it cathartic? Is it?
It's totally being with my son, supporting him. It is a therapy also. This is who I was before. I mean, I didn't start it painting. I painted it before everything happened. So I'm not changing my ways at all. This is who I am. This is what I know. This is my comfort zone. In an uncomfortable way, but it's what I know how to do. So it's very hard, actually, to go through the process of starting and finishing the painting. But there's also a lot of support from students and people that love what is happening. They get, again, there's a big connection that brings you that strength that you need to go ahead and finish it.
Patricia Oliver, I know that you're a witness to this this as you started this organization together. What does it mean to look at your husband's work to see it come to life? What do you make of the murals?
Well, it is very hurtful to me to see that, you know, what is he bringing to life, because somehow you can see some life of Joaquin in every mural. That, you know, that we are, even though that we are in a mission, that we know for sure Joaquin will be the first leader in Change the Ref. Also, it makes me accept. I have to deal with the acceptance that this is happening because of what happened to us. So to me, it's like a process. It's therapeutical, but maybe it could be the opposite. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of mixed feelings there. So to me, it's very exhausting. It's really very exhausting.
Both very very brave to come out, not only on this radio show, but, you know, even to be, you know, to be in large groups in cities and places. But it sounds like you are surrounded, as you said, by people who are in the middle of this with you. Can you talk a little bit about the message you're trying to send to Smith & Wesson? I mean, it may be obvious as a gun manufacturer, but what are you saying when you go to Springfield?
Well, number one, the location itself, the being able to bring Joaquin's voice to the same location that manufactured that weapon that was the one that was used at the shooting department, that is a strong thing to do. Now, here's the thing. We need to impact people in these actions. We believe that impacting people is way more powerful than convincing people. Convincing people will take a lot of time. So we need to be, we need the courage to show how the drama that we're living and how that could be a drama in any family, randomly. This could happen to anybody.
Right.
Okay.
And as you well know, this has happened to other families, as you
I
know, very well
even,
know, right?
Even, and just to finish my point, even to anybody that works at Smith & Wesson. That's
right. Their
so
children.
We're all exactly. Risking our kids' lives.
Right. So tomorrow is the 19th anniversary of the Columbine shooting. It is a national student walkout. You're participating in something that's aligned with that. It's more than 5 years after the Sandy Hook shooting in Connecticut. You're trying to impact the public, and you're trying to make an impression on Congress and the lobbying groups like the NRA. But is there something that's going to make it any different now with what you're doing?
Yes, the new voters. I believe that this time the victims are defending themselves. Not only that, the victims are used to receive fast answers because they're under technology through their whole lives. so they don't have much patience in here. So I really think there's a difference between this time and others because of the impatience and power of these young leaders.
Mm-hmm. And Patricia, have you met some of these are classmates of your sons. Have you met them? Have you seen them since the shooting?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're pretty powerful kids.
Yeah, they are very powerful kids. And also you get impressed that they are so articulated and they are so determined to take actions from themselves. So that's what it makes, I think, a huge difference from the other events. This time, I don't know why, because they woke up and they say, yeah, okay, no more. We need to take out, you know, we need to take ourselves or go out and vote and do something to make the difference.
Right, and they are of that age, you know. I have a 17-year-old also.
Oh, wow, yeah. The oldest is 20 years old.
I want to thank you both so much for coming in. This is a big deal for you and for us, so thanks. Manuel and Patricia Oliver are the parents of Joaquin Oliver, one of the 17 victims of the Parkland shooting, and they will be in Springfield tomorrow unveiling a mural near the Smith & Wesson factory, joining a forum on gun control, and there's more information about this on our website, radioboston.org. Thank you both again so much.
Thank you, Jill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR station. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston.